Drive into summer savings at Burr Brothers Tire and Service with unbeatable discounts on all major tire brands like Goodyear, Bridgestone, Firestone, Pirelli, and more. Visit any Burr Brothers today because these summer tire deals are hot and won't last long. Burr Brothers Tire and Service. Complete auto care done better.
Welcome into the Jazz Notes Podcast. I'm Ben Anderson.
I'm Chandler Holtz.
It is May 7th. I can't believe it. It feels like it was just January 1st. We were doing our first broadcast or podcast episode of the new year, but it is midseason and the NBA draft's coming up quickly. Find us on Twitter at Ben's Hoops, at Chandler Holt KSL, and of course KSL Sports. You can find us on Facebook at KSL Sports, KSLSports.com, anywhere you're finding your social media. KSL Sports is the place to look. All right, big show for you today. As we've been doing at the end of the season, recapping players in groups. Today we're going to be doing the rookies, kind of looking back at their last season and how they played, high moments, low moments, and what their future looks like. Then we will get into a little bit of the news of the week. We'll actually start with that. And then, of course, wrap up the show with your mailbag. A lot of questions as well. Look, man, Jazz fans, threaten all you want that you're not going to like this team. You got to stop sending 15 questions into the mailbag every time we ask for a response, because Danny Ainge and Ryan Smith are going to see this and think that, yeah, you still care just as much as you ever did. And I think you do. So we'll take advantage of it. It's good for our podcast. We like answering those questions. So we appreciate everyone who has followed along and listened and helped build this a little bit, because people are listening. We appreciate that. That's very cool. All right, Chandler, where are we starting?
Let's start with the weekly news. First bit of news, probably not a lot of traction behind it, but I think still a little bit noteworthy. With the Jazz's future a lot in question, a lot of people don't know if it's another tank year coming up or maybe the Jazz are looking to buy. But regardless, Lauri Markkanen trade rumors have been heating up specifically with the Lakers.
Yeah, LeBron James on his podcast with his future head coach, J.J. Redick, was talking about how much they just drew up a play and just talking about this specific play that the Jazz run and the Warriors also run to get either Klay Thompson or Lauri Markkanen open. And it's not that uncommon of a play, but it's just a play that you can use for a big dead-eye shooter who can shoot above the break. And that's Lauri Markkanen. And LeBron says, I love him.
Yep.
And then he says, I love him because he used to wear my shoes, but I love him. I love Lauri Markkanen. That guy's awesome. And of course, Lakers fans meant, well, GM LeBron is targeting Lowry. The nice thing is, I'll tell you, one person who doesn't care what LeBron thinks is Danny Ainge at all. And is not going to do anything too buckled to what LeBron or the Lakers wants, probably specifically what the Lakers want. In fact, he'll just try and continue to swindle the Lakers out of future draft picks, which he's already done once. But the Lakers specifically don't have the assets, I think, to make a Lauri Markkanen trade. I don't think the Jazz value anything they have as highly as what it would cost to get Lowry out of Utah.
Yeah, no, definitely. Like, I feel like Utah would ask for multiple first-round picks and either a young star or a current star coming back. And, like, Austin Reeves and Rui Hachimura are really cool, and you can, and Lakers picks.
And the Jazz might like them.
Yeah, exactly. And then the Lakers picks, even going into 2030, we don't know what they're going to look like then. Those could be very valuable, but just simply not valuable enough for how the Jazz see Markkanen.
Yeah, the Lakers right now, they do have a pick this year. As long as New Orleans doesn't pick it, like, there's this weird situation where New Orleans gets to pick if they want the Lakers draft pick this year or next year. I've actually never really seen a team do that. They've got this weird option. Generally, you have to say one year or the next. But this year would be the 17th pick. If I were New Orleans, I might wait. Unless they've already activated it and I missed it. I apologize if that's the case. But yeah, they have this opportunity to pick when they want to take the Lakers pick. I might wait and just see if the Lakers get worse next year, because they're not getting younger. Now, they could trade all these picks and try and get a superstar, but they need to have this year's pick. So they need New Orleans to not grab this year's pick, be able to trade this year's pick. They'll have another one in the future, and then their 2031 or whatever it is becomes available because it's 7 years out and you can trade picks up to 7 years out. They could do that. But like those three picks, and like you said, Rui Hachimura and Austin Reeves is probably not enough.
No.
If I'm trading Lowry, I want a lot quickly. I want a young guy who's going to project as a good player. The problem now, if we want to reflect on the Rudy Gobert trade, which I know a lot of Jazz fans have done because the playoffs have been so beneficial to the Timberwolves and how Rudy's playing, is that all those guys they got back have not panned out, with the one exception maybe being Walker, and he's coming off of a pretty rough season.
Yeah.
So, you know, Leandro Bolmaro is not in the NBA anymore. You flipped Patrick Beverley for Talen Horton-Tucker, and he's not going to be on the team next year. And then you also got Malik Beasley and Jared Vanderbilt, and they're not on the team. So, like, the five guys you got, none of them have stuck. Whereas Cleveland is bearing so much fruit because you got Lowry and you got Collin, and you've turned Ochai into another first-round draft pick, but at least you have two guys who you're kind of, I mean, they're the two best players on your team,
yep.
and you're still somewhat building around them. So that's been the hard part about that trade. So if the Jazz were to trade players, Colin, Lowry, whoever, I don't think they just want salary relief and draft assets. I think they want players and draft assets, and I don't think Austin Reeves and Rui Hachimura are future needle movers the way I think Lowry still could be. And we'll talk, we got some questions in the mailbag about Lowry, so we'll talk about that then.
Next piece of news, and not just rumors here, actual news. The Smith Entertainment Group requests a new lease and city blocks for a revitalization project downtown. Basically, the biggest piece of news here is they want to lease the two additional blocks to the east of the Delta Center.
So really, kind of first south, which is, you know, Japantown as they call it. It's that, what if you were to go straight east from the Stockton and Malone statues, you go straight up there. It is a bad street. There's just not a lot there. There's not a lot of economy there. It doesn't really make sense to have your arena dump 18,000 people onto the streets and have Park Place, which is a parking lot that, I mean, you got to have parking spots, but no one goes across the street. No one goes east to the convention center. There's nothing to do.
Yep.
And then that street to the Japantown Street is cool, and I love the old Japanese church, but there's no restaurants. There's a nice new hotel or a condo complex or apartment complex they built, but like there's no money coming into it or out of it. So they want to bulldoze that area. I think they want to, and maybe that, you know, maybe they keep the church or whatever. I have no idea. They're presenting some of those ideas this week. But yeah, maybe they just burrow right straight up to City Creek, and then you have a bunch of different businesses and opportunities to have people either leave and go to the Jazz game or leave the Jazz game and go to those businesses. And Ryan Smith wants control of that, and I think that's a big part of this push. I'm happy the team's staying downtown.
Yes.
Regardless, that's the push. I'm glad that they're not moving to Southtown Mall, which is where the hockey team is going to be practicing now, and they're building that. That could have been where they built this new arena, which wouldn't have been as difficult as Bluffdale or way out south, but still happy to have them downtown Salt Lake.
Do you want to take a break now or get into the players?
Let's do the players quickly, and
okay.
We can take a break after. Again, we've been doing our recaps. Last week, we did kind of the three standout vets, Lowry Markkanen, Colin Sexton, John Collins. If you missed that, go and find last week's Jazz Notes episode. This week, we're looking at the three rookies, because if I were to define this year, I would say those are probably kind of the six players that painted it.
Definitely.
You know, there are still the Jordan Clarksons. He's injured so often this year. The Walker Kesslers, the Chris Dunns. We will get into those guys in a future episode. But the three rookies were such an essential part of what this season was about for the Utah Jazz, certainly worthy of their own podcast.
Yes, definitely, especially after the trade deadline when a lot of the key rotation players sort of got shipped out. The Jazz turned to the young guys, and for them, as we'll get into shortly, a lot of their best moments came later in the year. Let's start with Keyonte George. For Taylor Hendricks and Bryce Sensabaugh, a lot of their opportunities came later in the season, specifically after the trade deadline, like I just mentioned. But Keyonte, he played 75 games and started 44, I believe. And by the way, for each of these players, we're going to give their best moment, worst moment, and also just talk about their overall impact. This season, Keyonte averaged 13 points, 2.8 rebounds, 4.4 assists, half a steal, 2.5 turnovers. For his best moment, I had the first 2 weeks of March. There were five games played there. In one game, he played just 6 minutes, so I sort of scratched that. In the other four games, 31 points, 29 points, 26 points, and 25 points, averaged 27.8, 5.2 on 50, 40, 84 from the field.
He had some really strong stretches. And we'll talk about it, obviously, the low point of the season. But you can go through and you can pick several 7, 10, 12-game stretches where he was really pretty dynamite. His shooting wasn't ever great, and that was kind of the issue for him this season. Because I could pull up, you know, November 14th through December 11th, 13 games, a month's worth of work. He averaged 14.5 points and 5.7 assists and 3.8 rebounds. The problem was he shot 35% from the floor and 32% from three. So that's not good enough. You can put up numbers and be Trey Burke and be that guy. That's unfortunately, that's just not an NBA quality. You can't shoot that low. Now, I'm not that worried about it because he's a rookie.
Yep.
You know, and rookies don't shoot all that efficiently, and there's some history of guys significantly improving their shooting numbers. But if you were to start on January 13th and go up through, I mean, you could go up to his next real injury. He gets sick in that game against Chicago, against Washington and leaves early. There is I'm pulling up the stretch here, 21 games. He starts eight. He averages 14.4 points, 4.8 assists, or 4.4 assists, and is up to 43% shooting and 39% from three, and that's 21 games.
Yeah.
That's a long stretch. That's a quarter of an NBA season. 21 games from a rookie where he averages 14-4, which, again, aren't blowing the roof off. He only started 8 of those 21 games, played 27 minutes a night, but was shooting a very efficient 40, 3% and 29 or 39% from three, I will take that. So it's almost hard for me to nail down like the Keyonte George moment this year. I do have one, and it is a specific game, but just to, I think, go back and kind of not have revisionist history of just like painting it by how he closed the season, which was difficult. There were a lot of really bright spots and good stretches where Jazz fans were like, this guy's the future and the star and might be better than Donovan Mitchell. Now, you know, Donovan's really good, as we've learned in the first round of the playoffs, and we knew here from his time in Utah. But he was getting people really excited at that. I will go with the game going into the All-Star break, though, against the Golden State Warriors. 33 points. I think that was his season high.
Yep.
He was awesome. 33 points, 7 assists, 5 rebounds. Shot the heck out of the ball, knocked down, what was it, tied a rookie high for 9 made threes. Like, okay.
Awesome game.
Yeah, you can be awesome. And maybe you're not going to be that awesome every night, but I know you can get there, and I like that you can get there. You've got to find out now how to eliminate, you know, if you had 20 bad games as a sophomore, you got to cut that down to 10. You can't have 20 bad games. You can have 10 next year. And you also have to double the number of good games you had. So these 30-point games, you had 5 or 6 of them. You have 10 of them next year, and then continue to refine that. But that game against Golden State, yes, the Jazz lost. They only lost by 3. He played 40 minutes. Basically, everybody was hurt in that game, if I remember correctly, and he was going toe-to-toe with the Warriors. And by the way, he was like chasing Steph off screens and playing unbelievable defense, which, again, is like one of those things you want to see. At a moment when I thought, this dude's got to be so tired going to the All-Star break, this might be the worst stretch of basketball he's going to play, and he stepped up and was awesome. So give me that. He fouls out of that game in 40 minutes, but I think that was the high point against Golden State and what you hope he can get back to regularly.
Definitely. I think one of the biggest differences between Keyonte and the other two rookies is, like you mentioned, he had longer stretches of the year, 21 games for the one that you mentioned, where he was great, right? He looked like an NBA player, and not only that, he didn't even look like a rookie, right? There wasn't a lot of efficiency or defense problems. Granted, never had really good defensive stretches, but I feel like with Hendricks and Sensabaugh, their best moments were maybe a handful of games or a game.
Honestly, can't even be a quarter.
Yeah.
Sometimes where you're like, oh, that was exactly what you want to see from Bryce Sensabaugh. Like,
yep.
He dominated this first quarter, and that was good enough. A lot bigger sample size for Keyonte, which is going to bring more good and more bad,
yes.
Which basically all rookies are going to show if your name's not Victor Wembanyama.
Yep.
So overall, I thought some real bright spots for Keyonte. What's his low point?
For his worst moment, and like you said, more opportunity could be bad as well, and that's sort of what we talked about later in the season when Markkanen and Clarkson and all these other guys went down. Keyonte rose to the top of other team scouting reports, had the better defenders on him, and he struggled as a result. But for his worst moment, I had the first 10 games of the season.
Of
course, getting acclimated to the NBA, averaged 7 points, 4.5 assists, and he shot 37% from the floor, 30% from three. And then, yeah, I also noted that he struggled in like the last 2 or 3 weeks of the season.
Now, the nice thing about that is, you know, those first 10 games of the season, he averages 4.6 assists and 1.7 turnovers. He's got a 3-to-1 assist to turnover ratio. And everyone was like, oh, this guy's got way more ball skills than we thought. He's like way more of a point guard than he showed at Baylor. And the Jazz belief that he could be that guy was really promising. But he also had a lot of bad shooting nights. I'm going to go with when the turnovers really cranked up. I thought that was a little bit concerning. Now, Kevin Pelton and ESPN people will tell you, like, there's no reason to ever worry about rookie turnovers. Generally, that's a sign that, like, they're trying and they're going to make mistakes that you're going to be able to clean up. The weird thing about Keyonte's turnovers were they were just like throwing the ball out of bounds, like overthrowing guys by 3 or 4 feet, sometimes just dribbling the ball off his foot, get ripped a lot early in the year, then not as much late in the season. But a lot of his turnovers were just like, where is your mindset? Where is your head at? Because the team kind of needs you to play well right now and steady the ship, and he wasn't able to do that. So I will say after that really good stretch he had where he was shooting the heck out of the ball, and it really starts when Lauri Markkanen leaves the lineup late in the season. He's got that shoulder injury or elbow injury, whatever he was dealing with late, and isn't sticking around very long. Keyonte's turnovers just skyrocketed, and we can start with the game against Minnesota on March 16th. Really, basically, through the second-to-last game of the season, he had a really good final close, ironically, again, against Golden State. Apparently, that's the team he plays well against. But his 15 of his final 16 games of the season, he shoots 33% from the floor, 22% from three, 4 assists and 4 turnovers. And you're like, oof.
Yikes.
Like, not an NBA player at that level. You know, no, I don't believe that at all. He's playing without anyone else on the roster that's any good. He's sharing the floor a lot of time with 2 other rookies in Taylor Hendricks and Bryce Sensabaugh. And you don't have either Jordan Clarkson or Lauri Markkanen on the floor, and they were very closely correlated. Like, as soon as those guys left, his numbers fell off dramatically. Well, yeah, a rookie thrown out there to himself who's not a number one overall pick trying to navigate what's being asked of him at the end of his rookie season when he's exhausted, I think is too much to ask. And the Jazz found out that out. They just asked too much of him late. He was not ready to carry all of that. But I will say that, yeah, 15 of his last 16 games, excluding the season finale, he really struggled. So you got to figure out a way to not ask that much of him because you can't burn him out. You don't want to ruin him by asking too much.
For overall impact, I had it as good. If we're doing grades, I'd probably put it around like a B. He was the Jazz's rookie of the year. Like I said, he played in 75 games, the only rookie to get consistent minutes throughout the season. And I think he had his fair share of clutch and notable moments. I think about, I want to say it was against the Heat where he had a really good fourth quarter.
Here, right after Christmas? Right, leading into the holidays or reading into New Year's, had a huge game.
Yep.
Yeah, and was cooking those dudes. Tyler Hero, Bam Adebayo, like was getting switches and it didn't matter. He was going to step back and hit a shot over you and just had it all going.
Yep.
You saw it. You saw the glimpses. Overall, good. I mean, he was the Jazz best rookie.
Yep, without a doubt.
And you got him with the 16th overall pick, and it wasn't your pick. It was Minnesota's pick. And again, you just have to hit on guys because whether they're the linchpins of your team and the cornerstones going forward or guys you can trade, you just can't have James Bouknight, who can't play, or Kai Jones, who can't play, that you use a lottery pick on, and you're like,
great.
Wasted season.
Yep.
Like, wasted asset. Nothing there. Absolutely a whiff. Nothing to use there. And that's not at all what you could say about Keyonte George. Does he have to get better? Of course he does. But a good start. A good foundation to build on. And again, he's 20.
Definitely.
You know, he's 20 years old. His future, I expect a good second season. I told you I thought, in the right scenario, he could average 20 points per game next year. I still would not rule that out. I don't know if he's going to get there, probably closer to 16, 17, 18. But, if it clicks in his second season, which a lot of guys make that jump in their second year, it could really help him.
Next up, let's talk about Taylor Hendricks, the Jazz's top selection in the draft last year. He averaged 7.3 points, 4.6 rebounds, 0.8 assists, 0.7 steals, 0.8 blocks, 0.7 turnovers. I think that's the big thing with his stats, the 0.8 assists, 0.7 steals, 0.8 blocks, because you're looking at that, and I feel like in the next couple of years, he can get to maybe 1.5 and above in all of those, and then he's sort of looking like an AK-47 kind of player filling up the stat sheet. For his best moment, month of April, right, the Jazz were very shorthanded, got a lot more opportunity, averaged 9.1 points, 4.3 rebounds, 1.3 steals on, here's the kicker, 52% from the floor, 54% from three. He shot 50% or higher in 5 of 7 games in April, and he had 2 games with 3 steals.
There were some really bright moments for him. The game that I remember specifically that stands out, it was one of the losses in the season where you were like, oh yeah, the Jazz are really tanking. The Jazz are really pushing for this thing to not work. In fact, it was coming out of the All-Star break. They lose to Charlotte in Salt Lake City when Charlotte was dreadful. But he has 12 points. The most important part was he had 9 rebounds, including 5 on the offensive or 4 on the offensive glass, and was just getting like cutting dunks off of misses and was kind of outplaying Brandon Miller. Brandon Miller ended up having a good game, I think, if I remember correctly. But like, you just saw it. Like, his activity was through the roof. And in fact, to the point where I was like, man, why doesn't Walker Kessler play as hard as Taylor Hendricks does? Like, if he just played that hard, he would be really effective. But Taylor was playing hard, getting out and running. He only shot 1 of 5 from 3, which, again, I think sometimes there's this myth, or it's easy to confuse a guy shot well so he had a good game. I like that it was all the other stuff that was working. It was like really instinctual reads on the glass, getting out, playing the floor, using his size to just be bigger than everybody. And that was something that I thought consistently Taylor Hendricks did that I liked. He knows he's really athletic, and he knows he can finish above the rim, and he's not afraid to do it. I think that was really beneficial for him. So weirdly, not his best game, but maybe his best effort. I thought that Charlotte game really stood out to me. But you know what? The number of double-digit games he had where he kind of just accidentally gets there because he is 6'9", he's very athletic, blocks some shots, and he can rebound. I thought that was pretty encouraging. I thought there was enough bright spots this year to feel like, yeah, that guy could absolutely live up to his billing as a number 9 overall pick.
Yeah, he gets a lot of putbacks too, something I've noticed. For worst moment, I had the month of December, right? So best moment, April, worst moment, December. He played in 10 games. He had 15-plus minutes in 7 of those games, averaged 5.7 points, 2.7 rebounds on 38-31-83 splits. I noted that he didn't really look NBA-ready until March or April, even though he got his opportunities after the trade deadline in February. It took him a little bit to get acclimated, and then once he even got into the starting lineup for some games, that's when he sort of started to have an impact.
Yeah, I thought just the roughness of some of his early games in general, and maybe the fact that he only played once in the first 19 games for the Jazz as a top 10 pick, you're like, ugh. But you actually look back at this draft, a lot of guys drafted in the lottery did not play hardly at all this year, and Taylor Hendricks fits into that group and then got into the rotation a lot. On the second half of the season, one weird thing that I would say was a little bit of a, I don't want to say red flag, that's going to sound strong, so don't run with this, Jazz fans, thinking that there's some disaster on their hands, was his end-of-season interview. He's like, I want to work on my ball handling and get better at that. And Will Hardy was like, well, how about we learn how to play defense and fix our shot mechanics? And it was like, do you guys have the same idea of what your role is supposed to be? Because Danny Ainge, in his end of season, said, you saw what Taylor's role is, and that's who he's going to be. And Taylor was like, I think I'm going to be a great offensive player. It's like, are you guys on the same page of what is coming? They will be.
Yep.
But I just kind of thought that was a weird, like, oh, you guys still aren't totally aligned on the communication part of, like, Taylor didn't even say the right things. Which is funny, you know, and weird, and maybe he sees himself as a star, and then you hope that he's just okay continuing to do this. And look, if he gets better offensively and can handle and turn into this kind of dynamic wing with the ball in his hands, A+, awesome. But the Jazz are also right, Will Hardy's also right, that just, like, become a great defensive player. Look at what's going on right now in Minnesota and Boston and these teams that actually have a chance to compete in the finals. Go be that. Yep. Go be that role player who's stellar defensively, and you can throw on Jamal Murray for 5 straight possessions and frustrate him and get him flustered. Do that. And then worry about, like, can you dribble? Jaden McDaniels never dribbles.
No.
But he hits open threes, and he plays his mind, plays out of his mind defensively. Okay, so try and figure out how to become that guy, and then whatever else we get will be beneficial from the Jazz perspective. That would maybe be my low point. It's just like, oh, what does the future look like here? But otherwise, you know, I thought you saw enough to justify the size, the athleticism, just some of the raw skills, continuing to put it together, that the production was there even before the skill has gotten there.
Mm-hmm. For overall impact, I had decent, maybe like a C, C minus if you put it into a grade. Like I said, took time for him to be ready for NBA minutes. He's already an impact defender, not necessarily like on ball. I think we described Ochai this early in the season. He's like a defensive playmaker, right? He can get highlights on that end and lead to offense. Although he is inconsistent on offense and doesn't really contribute to winning yet.
Again, he had this weird thing where he jumped onto the Jazz the first time in December when they went on that hot streak.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they got healthy again, he was out of the rotation. He comes back after the trade, so of course they're not nearly as good as they would have been. Like, I actually think he probably would have looked really good next to Kelly Olynyk. You know, a guy who knows how to set him up, can do some of the big-to-big passing, make his life a little easier, space the floor for him, find him in the corners. Like, a lot of those things would have been beneficial if he was playing next to 40% shooter Simone Fontecchio, 40% shooter Kelly Olynyk, and he wasn't the only big who could space the floor for the Jazz.
Yeah.
You know, and then once he really is in the lineup, Lowry's out of it. So it's hard to judge, like, how good would he have looked next to actual players. Jaden McDaniels is awesome. He would look a lot less awesome if he was not playing next to Kat and Ant and Rudy Gobert.
Very true.
Like, his things that he does so well don't stand out as well on a team that needs scoring or needs a lot of big offensive impact, because that might not be where Taylor Hendricks is, but a star role player who blocks shots, gets putbacks, like you said, cleans up a lot of the mistakes, all of a sudden that guy looks super valuable. They don't look as good on teams that are so far from being complete like the Jazz are. So overall impact was probably a little bit higher than I think he was able to show,
mm-hmm.
and will look better once, again, the Jazz have a more complete roster.
Very true. Like you're saying, Taylor Hendricks and Jaden McDaniels are both like complementary players. So when you don't have that talent around them, it sort of lessens the impact that they can have. While talking about Keyonte, he's more of a primary option, more of a ball handler. So when those other people aren't there, maybe he won't suffer as much, but what hurt him is that defenses were paying more attention to
exactly
him.
Right.
Yeah.
So make everyone's life a little bit easier by having the other players on the floor. And look, I think there's a decent chance Taylor's in the starting lineup next year.
Oh, definitely.
You know, we'll see what acquisitions the Jazz make this offseason, but I think Collins starts. I think Lowry's starting, assuming these guys are all on the team. John Collins probably still starts. Like, Taylor probably makes the most sense there if you're not going to start Walker Kessler, and they have not been able to figure out John Collins and Walker Kessler. So Taylor makes some sense.
Last rookie here, Bryce Sensabaugh, 7.5 points, 3.2 rebounds, 1.7 assists, 1.5 turnovers for Bryce. Let me look at his stats really quick. He played 32 games, started in 11, shot 39% and 29.6% from three.
So I will say the high mark for Bryce is how quickly his game adapted to being an NBA game. Because the big question about Bryce coming out of Ohio State was, like, how do you get a guy who only shoots mid-range jump shots to be an NBA player? And what you realize is like, oh, no, I think he's actually going to be a really good three-point shooter. Now, again, if you only look at the box score and say, well, he shot 29%, what are you talking about? I felt this way. I think a lot of Jazz fans felt this way. Danny Ainge clearly felt this way because he said at the end of the year, Bryce can shoot better than his numbers imply. Bryce is a good shooter. His numbers don't say that, but he, again, he hit a crazy wall where between, and this may be just be his low point, between March 9th and March 29th, 20 days, 11 games, he shoots 11% from three on four attempts a game, and it submarined his three-point shooting, which had actually been kind of a strength. He was knocking down at least two a game for a stretch there. It felt like, okay, this is going to be his style of play. He had enough games where he went 5 of 10, 5 of 9, 4 of 7, that I believe in his ability to be a three-point shooter. So his high note is that I think his game actually has a role in the NBA, and I didn't know if that was the case coming out of Ohio State.
You must have a look at my notes because that's exactly what I said. Quickly adapting. His worst moment for me was month of March. His best moment was the month of April. In April, averaged 12.1 points, 4.4 rebounds, shot over 41% from three, didn't miss a free throw in the month of April, double digits in four of those seven games. But then going back to March, he was still getting significant minutes, 22.1 minutes, sorry, played in 15 games. And then excluding that final game of the month in March where he dropped 22 against Sacramento, like you said, just abysmal shooting. Averaged 7.6 points, 4.1 rebounds, 36.7% from the floor, and 17.5% from three. And he had two. This is what I think is big for Bryce. He had two or more turnovers in 10 of 15 games in March.
Yeah.
So,
got to cut that down.
Yeah, definitely.
He's got to slow down. He's got to make better decisions with the ball, and that did become an issue. He started just throwing the ball all over the floor, as did Keontae George. And he was asked to do a lot of playmaking and ball handling and making decisions that he wouldn't have to if he was just a spot-up shooter.
Yep.
Which, my kind of funny thing was, can he just step in and do the Simone Fontecchio role a little bit? Can he just kind of step in and be that guy who, I mean, Simone didn't dribble. He didn't make decisions with the ball. His one dribble would be a sidestep so he could shoot another open three. Can you get Bryce? Can you convince Bryce to do that? Don't dribble forward, dribble sideways.
Yep.
Just get yourself open. And then if you get out in transition, fine. Get out in transition and make a play there. But I do like about Bryce, like, he had a 12-rebound game. He had an 8-rebound game. He had a 7-rebound game. You look at his assist numbers. He had a 5-assist game or a couple of 5-assist games, 4 assists. Like, there's enough feel there where it's just like, oh, he can do a little bit more than just shoot or just dribble. There's enough kind of like bright spots there that I thought were promising enough. And I know he can score. And that's, you know, guys who can score do stick in the NBA. So, again, there was the Jazz hit on these three rookies. How good they're going to be, I don't know. But I don't think I saw a whiff in this group. Now, are they 5-year NBA players, 10-year NBA players? Are they the sixth guy in your rotation? Are they the third guy? Those are long studies are going to be required to figure out how long it's going to take them to get there, or if they ever get there, it's just going to take a bigger sample size. But there's something there. I was intrigued.
That was the big thing that I had written down for Bryce as well. For Taylor, we knew that he was going to be a project sort of player, but we also had faith in his ability to get there, mostly because of his athletic gifts. And then Keontae was definitely the most NBA ready of the three, but especially after his performance later in the season when he got a lot more opportunity, Bryce showed that he is a real NBA player.
Like, I think
he has a lot of potential in certain areas. He proved himself as a scorer and a shooter. There's a lot to be desired with playmaking and defense, but I think that he can get there.
And has a unique body, which, again, it's just part of the NBA. It's just like, are you unique? Are you bigger than the other guys who play your position? Or do you do something that's different than what the other guys that are very replaceable and what's going to allow you to stay? And it's just like, he's big, he's strong, he's going to come back in better shape next year. I think he's going to light up the summer league would be my guess. I could be wrong. He could absolutely not be able to hit a shot and look terrible and everyone say, oh, sell on him now if you can. But he can score. And I think his body's going to be in pretty good shape and better than it was last year. And again, it's important to remember with he and Taylor, they were both coming off injuries in the summer, didn't get to play summer league, so didn't even get that taste of like what it's like. So their first opportunities in the NBA were playing against real NBA players or going to the G League, which is probably not what they were hoping to start their careers. Hopefully you get a more kind of predictable offseason, go to the summer league, figure out what you're doing well, what you're not doing well, and come into training camp ready to go. All right, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, we will get into the Jazz mailbag. Stick around, more Jazz Notes coming up next.
911, emergency.
They kidnapped my son.
What would you do if your child disappeared and someone you trusted was responsible?
We thought he cared for McKay, when in fact he didn't care for anyone.
Listen to Ransom now at ransompodcast.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make?
window instead of middle seat, picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket, outsourcing business tasks you hate. What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Grand Canyon University makes earning your degree possible with over 130 academic programs for traditional campus students, with more than 80 bachelor's programs offered online. GCU provides you with the personal support you need, from complimentary unofficial transcript evaluations within 24 business hours to scholarships, academic support, and your GCU graduation team, led by your own university counselor. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Jazz Notes podcast. Ben Anderson, Chandler Holt. That first segment was a little long. Appreciate everyone sticking with us as we reviewed the Jazz rookies. But let's get into the funnest part of the podcast, my favorite part of the podcast, I should say, which is the mailbag. We send out a prompt every Tuesday around 11 o'clock asking for your questions for the mailbag. And we got a lot, as always. So let's answer them.
First up from Jake Hatch, should Cleveland and Minnesota continue to win in advance? Do the assets the Jazz acquired from them in the Donovan and Rudy trades get devalued?
And I will assume he means continue to win in advance this season.
Yes.
Not in the year's future, which, like, yeah, if you win every year for the next 5 years, the Jazz assets are not going to be very good that they got.
Yeah.
But Jake's smarter than that, so I understand what he's asking. A little bit, as far as, like, their immediate trade value, like, you have Minnesota's pick next year. It looks like Minnesota might be the best team in the NBA next year. You're probably getting the 30th pick. Shoot. You got the 16th pick from them last year that turned into Keontae George. 15 spots worse. That's a bummer. Now, you are one Anthony Edwards twisted ankle that's going to cost him 20 games from it being the 20th pick.
Yep.
So that's why you bet on these teams' futures, and you kind of bet the under, and you hope that they lose games and get injured and have a Memphis Grizzlies-like season, and you take over their pick. That's the goal. But the truth is, like, man, I just don't know how long teams are good anymore. I just don't. If you would have asked me in 2021, in 2024, who I thought the good teams were going to be, I would have said the Milwaukee Bucks and the Phoenix Suns. And they made the playoffs. They're disasters. They have no way to fix their rosters. So I would have told you they would be awesome, and probably they, between the two of them, there would have been another title, and neither has gotten particularly close.
No.
At all. So I actually kind of don't think it hurts that much. Next year's pick is going to be hurt, which is fine. That was not the pick you were, like, hoping for. It was not 2025 Minnesota pick. It really is the 2029 and the 2027 pick. Your 2026 pick swap, I bet you wish it was 2028, just so it was a little bit further in the future as opposed to sooner, while they're still under this umbrella where they can have Mike Conley and Rudy Gobert under contract. But again, they're really expensive. Mike Conley is 36. Like, he's awesome right now. He is 36. He's 6 feet tall, and he's got a lot of wear on his tires. History will tell us that at some point the drop-off is going to be there. Same with Rudy Gobert. History tells us, if you look at the DeAndre Jordans and the Tyson Chandlers of the world, these seven-footers who are rim runners don't play until they're 36 and 37 effectively. Yes, DeAndre Jordan's still in the NBA. He's not good.
Yeah.
So you are hoping that Rudy drops off or is so expensive they can't afford to keep him and they lose him for a lot worse pieces, that he doesn't stay this level of Rudy Gobert. So 26, yeah, values hurt. 27, maybe in the pick. Or 25, yes, the values hurt. 26, maybe the pick swap is hurt. You're probably not planning on swapping with him in that spot. But that also overlaps with the Cleveland pick swap. Like, you just need one of those to be better than yours for it to be valuable. You can't trade one pick for two. So that's kind of where I am. I don't think it's as impactful as a lot of Jazz fans think it is.
No, definitely. I think that with the Minnesota assets, you sort of just have to let it run its course. Like, they're going to be really good, especially with Michael Jordan's son on the roster. But with Cleveland, like, if they lose this round, maybe even lose next round, like, Donovan's future in Ohio is still very much in question.
No, it doesn't. Yeah, I mean, they're not going to beat the Celtics.
Yes.
Barring Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum going knee to knee.
Yeah.
They're not going to win this series. And then it's just a huge question mark.
Yes. So, yeah, I think with Minnesota, you sort of let it run its course. But I think Jazz fans should definitely keep an eye out on what's going on in Cleveland.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've got Minnesota's payroll up. Next year, they're at $175 million. They don't even have Mike Conley's $10 million deal on here. So they're actually up at $185 million. So they're well over the luxury cap already, into the second apron. Jaden McDaniels is under contract for 6 years. That's awesome. Anthony Edwards is under five more years. Okay, you're set with those two guys, ideally, through 2028, 2029, and then they're good enough, at least Ant is good enough, that you hope you can build pieces around them. But, man, 2025, 26, Rudy has a player option after next year. He could pick it up for $46 million, and again, they're at $190, $200 million already in 2025, 26. Or, you know what, Naz Reid's not picking up his $15 million deal. And, like, look, Bruce Brown leaving the Denver Nuggets has been a huge loss for them. Well, if Naz Reid leaves Minnesota after next season and wants $28 million a year as opposed to $15, that's a huge drop-off, and that's when you, again, start to get into pick swaps and draft trades and all these things. It's just like, you just don't know. I wish we had a better idea of just, like, I know exactly what the value of that pick's going to be. It's just really hard to say. So to answer Jake's question, long story short, I don't think it changes that much.
Mm-mm.
Actually, next year it does. After that, it's anybody's guess in the NBA anymore.
Next up from Jake the Lynx, a future contending Jazz team would want a Lowry-type player on the team. Why do some people insist on trading him to tank? Why not just keep him and tank for a year if needed? Sure, it'll be frustrating making up injuries or whatever, but is it worth it in the long term?
Yes, you can. Well, look, Lowry could play 82 games next year and you could still only win 22 if he's your best player and it's just rookies around him.
True.
So you could do that. You don't even have to make up injuries for Lowry. You don't want to keep stretching Lowry thinner and thinner and being like, hey, we're never going to win here, and you're just going to be the face of a losing team, but at least you're paid handsomely. Like, I do think he has some pride and wants to win more than that. I do agree, because Karl Anthony Towns is a good example. Jaylen Brown's a really good example of this, of guys who, whenever the team falls short, which Minnesota fell short a lot, and Boston has fallen short of winning a title, I'm always like, maybe they should trade Jaylen Brown for an upgrade or for two pieces as opposed to one, and maybe it works better. And now they're headed to the finals, I think, and the Wolves are headed to the finals, I think. And, like, man, you're glad you had Kat, because Kat outplayed Jokic yesterday.
Yep.
And Jaylen Brown, when Jason Tatum doesn't have a good game, can step up and have 35. And you're like, man, thank goodness you have him. And thank goodness you didn't trade him 2 years ago when it felt like you needed a shakeup just to shake up the status quo. So I'm with you. You know, just don't trade Lowry.
Yep.
Because when you're good again, you're going to be thrilled that you have him, the way Boston's thrilled they have Brown, the way Minnesota's thrilled they have Towns.
Next up from Glenn Anderson, the lottery is coming up. If the Jazz get the number one pick, would you trade it or make the selection?
I think you got to make the selection. Jazz don't get a lot of number one picks. And still, usually in bad drafts, you want to have the number one overall pick. Now, the myth is that, I know the comps are for 2013 at this draft, and like Anthony Bennett goes number one overall, and that was a disaster. That was the wrong pick. They made the wrong pick, and they panicked, and a lot of people still had him projected eighth going in. So if the Jazz have the number one pick, and the guy who's eighth on everybody's board, let's just throw out, like, Matis Buzelis is, like, the guy who generally is available 5, 6, 7 in this every mock draft, and the Jazz, like, he's number one on our board. Well, don't just take him at one.
Yeah.
Sure, trade back to 4 and get him and do the Jason Tatum, trade that Danny Ainge made in the past, get the best player, and still try and get some more assets. Ideally, you could do that. But I think if you get the number one pick, you take the number one pick. Definitely. Unless, yeah, somebody comes out and says, oh, man, we really hate name a young star that's good in the NBA. Yeah. For some reason, OKC decides they hate Shea.
Yep.
It's like, okay, yeah, here's the number one pick. Or not Kyrie. Let's say Luka is like, I got to get out of Dallas. I hate it. Yeah, trade the number one pick. Fine.
Definitely, yeah.
But I'm probably not trading back. I think you just make the pick. Try and get the best player available. And again, as we talked about in our last podcast episode, there's a lot of guys in this draft who really fit.
Follow-up question from Glenn here. If they do decide to trade it, what type of value do you think it holds with no surefire prospect?
Not a ton.
Yeah, true.
Again, I've talked to some draft people, someone who really knows and says, I would rather have a pick 5 through 10 in this draft than 1 through 5. Because people are going to make big mistakes 1 through 5, and there's going to be good players on the board 5 through 10.
Yep.
Or 6 through 10 in that sense. So, I totally understand that. Again, you look at some of these drafts in the past where, yeah, like the second, third, and fourth picks were all whiffs, and then you kind of get into the guys who are less upsidey but have a little bit more proven track record, and you're like, well, yeah, those guys should have gone second, third, and fourth, but someone swung for the fences on Derek Williams, and he's terrible.
Yep.
So you will see that. I get that sentiment of why you would do that.
Next up from Utah Jazz News. I personally feel like there aren't enough players on the surface of the market that move the needle substantially for the Jazz, like Brandon Ingram, Murray, LaVine, and Hero. Don't take us to the next level. What are the odds we trade for a guy on that level? Because I wouldn't do that.
I think we get lost in the sense that you either have to have everything or nothing, and that good is the enemy of perfect.
Yep.
Or perfect is the enemy of good, I guess is the right way to say that. But we're kind of flipping it this way, which is like, oh, it's bad if the Jazz get good again if they're not competing for a title, which I think is a mistake. You can be good again, and still, once you get into this other point where hopefully Cleveland's bad and you get their draft picks, or Minnesota falls off and you get their draft picks, which again, may never happen. I get the idea that you wanted to have some of your own picks and you control your own picks. That's the value of having your own picks. If it's not working, you fall to the bottom again, you get elite draft picks, and hopefully you get elite players in response. I don't think you have to hope to go from the 28th best team in the NBA to the third in one offseason.
Yes.
I actually think it's smart at some point to get back to the mid-range, get to, you know, the 12th, 13th, 14th best team in the NBA, and then hope that you catch lightning in a bottle and, you know, a player becomes available in a trade and you've got all these assets, or you just randomly get the best player in the draft at 13, which, again, I know sounds like, well, that's never going to happen. Let's pull up the NBA teams remaining right now that are still in the playoffs and look at who their best players are or how they came from. Now, Jason Tatum, okay, you got him as the third overall pick. You had to win the number one draft pick to get it, but maybe not all that realistic of a situation. But remember, it was drafted with the Brooklyn Nets pick. It wasn't Boston falling to the bottom of the draft. They had the Nets pick in these blockbuster trades. I think it was still going back to the KG, Paul Pierce debacle that Brooklyn had. Well, that's what the Jazz have set themselves up with Cleveland, right? Somebody else has some lottery luck, and you steal their draft pick. Knicks traded for every one of their players or signed them. There's two players on their roster that play that they drafted. It's Deuce McBride, who was end of the first round, and Mitch Robinson, who was end of the first round. Otherwise, they signed Jalen Brunson. Now, look, Jalen Brunson's dad doesn't coach for the Jazz, so it's going to be a lot harder to sign him than the Knicks were. And you're not in New York, you're in Salt Lake. But they traded for Josh Hart for like one draft pick. They traded for OG Anunoby for picks that the Jazz could have matched that trade for OG Anunoby and gotten him if they wanted to. Like, okay, they built that team fine. They didn't need the number one overall pick. Cleveland literally had their best player as a guy who used to play for the Jazz. Like,
yep.
You could get there if you wanted to. The problem for Cleveland ultimately is that while they're good, they don't have any way of getting better. It just fully depends on Evan Mobley becoming a star, and he's not going to get there. And now because they don't have any draft picks, they can't do it, and they're pretty stuck. That's what the Jazz can't do, right, is get into this spot where they are good like Cleveland but don't have any versatility to move upward and have more growth. But you're okay if you're as good as Cleveland and get back to winning 48 games as long as you still own 8 future first-round draft picks and have young pieces to trade. And that's not crazy unrealistic at all, is it?
No.
I don't think that's all that hard to imagine. Pacers traded a good player for a good player and got Tyrese Halliburton. Otherwise, a bunch of their players are just like kind of guys.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when you're in love with. Miles Turner's never made an all-star team. I like Benedict Mathurin, but he's fine. You know, like, I don't know if he's going to be a star. Oklahoma City, we know they've tanked a bunch. They've had lottery luck. They're a little hard to replicate because you don't have Paul Pierce to trade for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Where did Denver's best player come from? Second round of the draft. Minnesota, hard to replicate. They have two number one picks on their team. They cashed in all their assets. Really smart trade that they made. And then Dallas got Luka with the fourth overall pick or whatever, third, and traded for fifth. I can't remember exactly what the trade was now, but it's like this idea that you have to be a disaster and lose 65 games, and that's the only way to get better, I think is wrong. So it's okay to be okay and then hope to have some lottery luck or hope you just draft really well in the mid to late lottery or even at 16, 17 that becomes the face of your franchise and you move from there. You don't need to be awful.
Definitely. I think that, and this is something that we've talked about before, is playoff experience leads to playoff success. Like, there's no one who's going to miss the playoffs for five straight seasons and then go win the NBA Finals as soon as they make it.
Right.
And I think that looking at these guys like Brandon Ingram, Murray, Levine, and Hero, like, as long as you're not paying a second-tier star $35 million a year, I think go for it. Like improve your roster, actually compete for something, put some fire under these guys, you know, so they're not just knowing that we're not really playing for anything, especially the last 2 months of the season. I think that as long as you don't overpay, whether it be in free agency or overpay for in a trade, I think it could be a good idea.
Just don't leave yourself without any outs.
Yes.
That's the important thing. The problem with the last Jazz is they had no outs. You had Rudy Gobert and Donovan Mitchell and Mike Conley and Bojan Bogdanovic and Jordan Clarkson, and you couldn't improve on that group. You weren't ever going to have good draft picks again, and you had no financial flexibility. There was nowhere to go but backwards.
Yep.
It's the only way. You had to back out of the driveway. This is a loop for the Jazz. You know what I mean? This is where you want to be is to have opportunities. That's where Minnesota actually is really intriguing, or OKC is intriguing, is not only are they good, okay, let's say Naz Reid opts out and Rudy Gobert opts out and you need to trade Kat. Well, you're going to get draft picks and you're going to have cap space and people are going to want to play with Ant. That's really beneficial. Cleveland has nowhere to go. They just have nowhere to go. So they've got to back out and they're going to trade pieces and hope to get lottery picks back. Phoenix has nowhere to go. They've lost all their versatility. So it's fine that they're good, but they don't have any way to improve. The Jazz can get good as long as they still have six or seven future draft picks, some theirs, some other teams, and financial flexibility. And I think that's what they're setting themselves up for, which is why I don't think good is the enemy of perfect for the Jazz going forward.
Next question here from James McKinney. What would your player comp be for Jalen Tyson? What do you think his floor is? Hearing him move up on big boards and wondering if he'd be a good pick for the Jazz at 29.
So Jalen Tyson is the wing out of Cal. I honestly have not watched Cal games yet. I've started my draft process. I've got three previews out already of Rob Dillingham, Reed Shepard. I did Cody Williams yesterday. I won't do one today, but I'll do one tomorrow and try and lead up to the lottery to make sure we have most of the players that are going to be talked about, regardless of what happens for the Jazz in the lottery. And then, of course, I'll continue to break down more and more. I almost watched Jalen Tyson yesterday, but I chose to watch a USC-Colorado game instead to watch Isaiah Collier. Here's what I like about, and we'll just throw Jalen Tyson in this group. I actually really like this draft 10 to 30. Now, ironically, that doesn't mean all that much for the Jazz, though they do have the 29th pick and they have the 32nd pick. If you wanted to package, though, and move up to 20 or 25, you might be able to do that with those two picks. There might be a team that says, yeah, we need two young guys, or we like the idea of two swings and we're not in love with anyone at 24. If you are, go up and find those types of players. But as I've kind of watched some of these ancillary pieces in the draft, like watching Colorado yesterday and seeing Tristan Da Silva, who's projected to go like 21, 22, 23. I'm like, man, that dude's 6'9 and shoots 40% from three. Like, okay, he's not Lowry. There's a little Kyle Kuzma there. He's probably not that athletic. He's not that good of a rebounder. But like, I could sell myself on a big guy who shoots like that. And then you look at this, these guys like Jalen Tyson. Like, yeah, like I totally get that, actually. I totally get why that guy would make sense. I watched a Miami game the other day. Kyshawn George is 6'8". Plays guard. I don't know exactly what the background is. Like, they're generally, when a guy is like, that guy's a lottery pick and they're at 28, there's something going on.
Yeah.
So always be wary of that with these freshmen. But it's like, man, if you told me Johnny Furphy ends up being really good, or Kyshawn George ends up being really good, or Devin Carter, the point guard from Providence, ends up being good, or Tristan Da Silva, all these names I mentioned, it's like, yeah, I totally get it. And that's not even to mention the guys at like 16, 15, 14 who are Jared McCain, Kyle Filipowski from Duke. Like, yeah. Those guys could be really good. We don't like this draft because the top five doesn't have stars.
Yep.
And I don't think it's going to bear all that many superstars, if any, but I really do like the talent beyond that. And everywhere I've looked, I'm like, there's size, there's kind of complete players, there's high upside swings still. So without answering your question about who I think Jalen Tyson is, I think he fits in this group of a bunch of players who could turn into actually pretty good NBA players. And we might have 8 to 10 players in that range selected who are still in the NBA a decade from now. Which, looking back at 2013, it's crazy to look back at, like, Steven Adams is still playing. Kelly Olynyk is still playing. Rudy Gobert, obviously, is the borderline superstar. Giannis is a superstar, but there's a lot of players from that draft that had a really long career. They just, everyone wanted superstars in the top 10 and didn't get them.
Nick T up next asks, can Reed Shepherd play the one? Seems like too good of a shooter to pass up.
He might be the best shooter I've ever seen. I'm not kidding. And look, there are, you know, the Salim Stoudemires and the Jimmer Fredettes of the world that come up, and that's like their only thing. Like, the practicality of his ability to shoot on top of whatever else he does is insane. 51%, 52% from the three-point line on four attempts a game, and was 55% from the floor. Like, every shot he takes looks like it's going in. He's awesome. He really is. He's a fabulous player. He's going to stick in the NBA. There's like five different comps I can have for him that are going to allow him to stick in the NBA. He could be, you know, J.J. Redick at worst, and not just to compare him to another white guy, which I know is what we always do, but like, the Derek White comparison is out there too from Boston. I'm like, yeah, I could see how that gets there. There's just a lot of different ways he sticks in the NBA because of his skill set. So can he play the one? He had to play off ball because Rob Dillingham had to play point guard at Kentucky this year because Rob is like as tall as a stool. He's just the smallest person I've ever seen. I think he's Isaiah Thomas, which is a hard bet to make that he's going to make the NBA, but he can really shoot the heck out of the ball again. So I bet Reed Shepherd can be a little bit of a, play a little bit of the one. And if he can, man, he's going to be a really good pick and a really good player. Again, I like this draft more than a lot of people do. I don't know if he can play the one. Kentucky didn't ask him to, but one of the issues with John Calipari historically, you can see Tyrese Maxey, Emmanuel Quickly, is everyone's like, oh, I don't think they're a playmaker. And then they get to the NBA, it's like, yep, they're playmakers.
Yep.
They just weren't asked to do it at all at Kentucky, or there was too many guys who were ball handlers. They didn't get an opportunity to run it solely by themselves. Plus, he just runs bad stuff at Kentucky, and we'll bring that to Arkansas with him. So maybe, but... if the Jazz ended up with Reed Shepherd at 8, you'd be happy. I would go size. I think you need size. I look at Minnesota and all these teams that are big, and I'm like, yeah, that's what wins in the NBA now. I would probably draft size and take a swing on that, but if Reed Shepherd was there at 8 and the Jazz picked him, I would totally get it.
Another question here about someone you've looked at. Jazz Time Jones asks, Cody Williams seems like the safe pick. Who is his comp?
His comp is hard. There's not a lot of 6'8", 190-pound players in the world. Like, he's really skinny. I've seen some comps to Jaden McDaniels, and I totally get it. Like, Jaden was not this defensive player when he was at Washington at all. Now, there were some different things at Washington. They were really good at getting NBA talent. They were coached really poorly. He played with Christian Stewart off also at UW. Really jumped off the screen watching them because of how elite his body was. Like, Jaden McDaniels at Washington already had this crazy frame. And Cody Williams does a little bit too. Now, Cody Williams is a better offensive player because he shot over 50% from the floor and over 40% from three. He never took them. Like, even Jaden McDaniels took a lot more shots. Again, the difference is UW had no good players on their roster. So he could kind of do whatever, and his body language was pretty bad. That's not at all the issue with Cody Williams. Cody Williams just played next to two other guys who are going to be in the NBA next season, Tristan Da Silva, who I mentioned, and KJ Simpson. So he had to defer to them because they were better than he was. And then they had this other guy, Lampkin, who's 6'6" and 300 pounds.
Yeah.
Like, he just plants in the paint, and you give him the ball, and he just bowls over you. I mean, imagine Kenneth Lofton, but 4 inches shorter, but nobody can guard him because he's so big. He just bulldozes you. Well, okay, that guy also kills all your spacing.
Yeah.
So Cody Williams, A, isn't getting opportunities to drive because he's the third best player on offense, and then there's nowhere to go because there's always a 300-pound guy sitting in there blocking up all your space. So I don't mind the Jaden McDaniels comp. It's always hard to compare, like, if you think he's going to become the third best perimeter defender in the NBA. He's a better offensive player. He's got a real weird variety of shots he makes. He was hitting hook shots and push shots and floaters and runners, really good in transition. He's the guy right now, and again, I'm early in this process. If he's there at 8, no question. I would take him. No question. 6'8". He's going to put on weight. He's a little injury prone right now. He had three kind of significant injuries, an ankle, a wrist, and a face. Wrist and face don't bother me at all. Like, if it's perennial knees or your back because you're so thin, that's a little fearsome. You got elbowed in the orbital bone. That's not your fault. And your wrist, like, you fell down.
Yeah.
You hurt your wrist, whatever it was. So that I'm not, so I'm actually not worried about the injuries that much. But Cody Williams, kind of a hard comp. Ton of upside, though. Man, if you give him some spacing and he gets some weight on his body, he's not going to be his brother. His brother's only 6'5 and weighs 20 pounds more than he does. He's 3 inches shorter and 20 pounds heavier. I believe his body will get there. A lot of the time you saw him playing at Colorado, he was only 18 years old. So big Cody Williams fan.
Two sort of similar questions here from Jay Christian and Brandon Whiteside. Why did the Jazz give up Nikhil Alexander Walker, and are you rooting for the Timberwolves?
Absolutely rooting for the Timberwolves. I really like Mike Conley. Rudy Gobert is a very strange person, but was always nice to me, and has been harmless off the floor. You know, he's not actively a bad guy. Seems like he treats people well. He's always been good to employees and staff around. So I like Rudy Gobert. I would love to see him hoisting a trophy and getting his flowers, because we saw him in Utah. He was good. He was legitimately very good. Why did he not work in Utah? Why was he included in this trade? Couple of things. First of all, revisionist history. He was not this good.
No, yeah, like, at all.
He had been okay. And remember, he was like, he came to the NBA out of Virginia Tech as a scorer. This guy was going to be a shooter and would light it up and then couldn't shoot. Shot 36% from the floor and 34% his first year from three. Second year, basically the same. Gets traded to Portland, shoots 31% from the floor or from the three-point line. Like, his shooting disappears. And then he starts to have real serious emotional issues. So talking to Nikhil, he's a really soft-spoken kid. He's really quiet. He talked a lot about, like, I have to go to I've been going to therapy because I have to learn how to forgive myself. He's a perfectionist and was not able to forgive himself for making mistakes on the floor. And I can't imagine what that pressure must have felt like, big picture, of being like, well, I'm not, this guy was supposed to be in the NBA and I was a borderline lottery pick and I'm letting everybody down and I'm letting myself down. So he was really hamstrung by that. Like, it was a real press for him. And anytime you talk to him, he wouldn't talk about basketball. He would talk about, like, therapy. And you're like, okay, this guy's going through it. Yeah. And you're hoping he just, like, is okay as a person. So I don't know why he was a throw-in in this trade. I don't know if he felt like he needed to get out of Utah. I know that he came in under Quinn Snyder and there was no place for him to play. And actually, understandably, you had Donovan, you had Mike Conley, and you had Jordan Clarkson. Like, you had a good three-man rotation. Jordan Clarkson was a season removed from winning sixth man of the year. Like, there probably wasn't that much opportunity for him. And again, he came into the trade deadline on a team that was trying to win in the playoffs, so they didn't have to blow up the roster. They made the playoffs. They still blew up the roster because they got eliminated in whatever, five or six games by the Dallas Mavericks. And then he's got a brand new head coach and really a new GM in Danny Ainge, who's in charge for the first time, really making decisions, and just never really figured out a role. So they throw him in this trade to Minnesota, and I think Chris Finch has bonded with him. And he's found a role that's perfect for him, which really, he's the eighth guy on that rotation. I know he's playing more minutes than that right now, but, I mean, we know the starting five, and then we know that Naz Reid's their sixth guy off the bench. So, yeah, he's 7-8 in that rotation. Monty Morris is up there, too. And he's just playing out of his mind. And he's only 25. Again, we give up on these guys really young. So, shout out to Nikhil. I think he's playing awesome, but I don't know if he ever would have reached this level in Utah. And, again, I feel like I've been talking for too long here, but don't overrate what he is, because, like, watch Indiana and all of a sudden, like, Aaron Nembhard is playing out of his mind. Well, who is that? Do I even have his right? It might not be Aaron.
Andrew,
exactly right. right? Andrew Nembhard's playing out of his mind.
Yeah.
I didn't say his first name right. Neesmith is playing out of his mind. Boston just gave up on him. Danny Ainge draft pick. They just gave up on him. There are a lot of good players in the NBA. Nikhil is one of them. But so is Neesmith. So is
Andrew Nembhard.
There's a lot of really good players in the NBA. Like, the 200th best player in the right role is perfect. Right now, Nikhil is playing the right role. He is not the 30th best player in the NBA. He's still the 200th, 250th, 300th best player in the NBA. But in the perfect role, he's awesome. So that's what you got to get. You got to get good enough so these guys in their roles, it goes back to our Taylor Hendricks conversation earlier, when you put him against the right players or next to the right players, they star. And Nikhil is finally in the right spot for the first time in his career.
While we're talking on the Timberwolves, I want to throw in my own mailbag question here.
Okay.
Let's assume we're in a world where the Minnesota Timberwolves are the NBA champions this year. What does that do for Rudy Gobert's legacy? Let's have some legacy talk. He's going to be a four-time Defensive Player of the Year, presumably.
Gets named tonight.
Yeah. Tied for most ever.
With Dikembe and Ben Wallace.
Yes.
Who are both Hall of Famers.
Yes. And then he was the linchpin for the number one defense in a year that that team wins the NBA championship. Does that make him like a top eight center of all time, maybe?
Let's see. Off the top of my head, Wilt, Bill, Hakeem, Jokic.
Shaq.
David Robinson are probably guys he could never catch.
Yes.
But he leaps Patrick Ewing.
Yep.
Right? He jumps some of those guys in that conversation, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably.
right? Which is crazy to think, but
like
I think
he's better
he's
than Dikembe at that level. Like Dikembe never won a title. Ben Wallace did. But yeah, that probably is weirdly that Rudy becomes the 10th best center in NBA history.
Yeah.
But he's legitimately in the conversation for the greatest defender in NBA history.
Mm-hmm.
Like Ben Wallace is there. Dikembe is there. We can talk about the Gary Paytons of the world or whatever, Michael Jordans and Scottie Pippens, etc. Like Rudy is the best anchor we've ever seen defensively in the modern era.
Yep.
You know, Ben Wallace was a little bit different, and Rudy's a better player than Ben Wallace. Like, I loved Ben Wallace. And when I fell back in love with the NBA, it's 03-04 Pistons. I loved that team. But Rudy Gobert is absolutely in that conversation, and then, you know, is critical on them winning a title. But he's absolutely in that group, and I would take him over Ben Wallace, in all honesty. So, yeah, I mean, that's crazy.
Yep.
Yeah, he's not Kareem. Yeah, you know, so he's going to always be remembered as the third best center of this era. He's not as good as Jokic, and he's not as good as Joel.
Mm-hmm.
And Joel is the MVP, and rightfully so, is a better player than Rudy.
Yeah.
But, man, there's no guarantee Joel wins a title. Jokic has his. He's never going to pass Jokic. But you're the third best center in the NBA for 10 straight years, and you win four Defensive Player of the Years. Was he a five all-NBA teams, seven all-defensive teams as soon as this gets named, including, I think, six first-team all-defensive teams?
Mm-hmm.
And then if he's a title winner... Yeah, I mean, he's already in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
He's already punched that ticket. That's going to be, it's an unbelievable NBA resume. What a crazy success story, and good for Rudy.
Next up, from Brandon Whitesides, was Don's attitude what divided the team? For example, Rudy calls out the team to play better defense in Utah, and he doesn't like it, where it sounds like Minnesota is on board in making those changes.
No. Look, there was a lot of why these things soured. Can I tell you the ultimate reason why the Jazz soured? They weren't good enough.
Yeah.
Like, there's a great segment. Go find it on Twitter right now if you haven't seen it yet. Find Anthony Edwards mic'd up from game one. It's unbelievable. Because we talk about him like, oh, he's moves like Jordan. Watch his leadership. It's crazy. Like, I didn't realize. He goes up to Rudy at one point. He says, stop doing all the ball handling stuff. He's like, stop doing all the ball stuff. Like, you can't dribble, Rudy. You're better when you do less. Okay, this is a 22-year-old telling a future Hall of Famer, stop doing that crap right now, otherwise we're going to lose this game. And Rudy listens. Now, Rudy might have punched Donovan Mitchell if they had said that. But why do you listen to Anthony Edwards and not Donovan Mitchell? Anthony Edwards is better. You got to listen to him. He's better.
Yep.
I don't know what to tell you. He's better than Donovan Mitchell was. He's better than Mike Conley. He's better than Quinn Snyder was as a coach. Like, Anthony Edwards is elite. And you're going to follow those elite guys. He's a legit number one superstar. And you will fall in line behind him because... not only does he talk the talk, he walks the walk.
Mm-hmm.
And the Jazz could have, Mike Conley's a great leader. Quinn Snyder was a good coach. They weren't good enough at what they do for Rudy to say, I will put myself aside to win. So no, it's not Donovan's fault. It's not Boyan's fault. It's not Jordan's fault. It's not just the Jazz blew a bunch of late first round draft picks. It's that they just weren't good enough. And they didn't have that guy. And now that Minnesota has that guy, everybody falls in line. Like, look at Mike. He talks to Mike Conley at one point, and Mike's like, okay, I'm listening. I'm listening to when Anthony Edwards talks. That is so insane for a 22-year-old to be doing. It's why he is the real deal. And as long as he keeps his head on straight and doesn't fall in love with himself and continues to put the hard work in, he will be a great leader, kind of in the mold of Jimmy Butler, who even has more fun. But people listen to Jimmy.
Yep.
Right? Everyone falls in line behind Jimmy. They'll fall in line behind Anthony Edwards, and it's because he's good enough. And that's the biggest issue.
Last question here from Mark Daniel. What has surprised you about the playoffs? Danny Ainge doesn't like losing deals. Any chance the Jazz go full tank the next few years just to avoid conveying a pick to OKC? And if so, can we turn the team over to Kenneth Lofton Jr. for a season?
Sure, turn the team over to Kenneth Lofton. That would be fun because he's a really fun player to
yeah.
watch. I don't know if I agree with just the basis, I guess, of that question in general as far as like, it's not Danny Ainge's trade. Like, that's not his deal. It was Dennis Lindsay's trade to get off of Derek Favors' bad contract that he sent. So, yeah, maybe he doesn't want to lose that trade. But, like, you're going to have to convey that pick eventually. And actually, I think it's still better to convey it next year so you have your pick swap rights with Cleveland 2 years from now. Like, all of a sudden, with the direction Cleveland's going, and maybe it just depends on what Cleveland does this summer, how aggressively the Jazz try and make the playoffs next year just to convey that pick. But... I think the Jazz are going to want to get there. Now, again, you could tank 2 years and never get to that spot. I don't think the Jazz are going to be this bad two more seasons in a row. I could be wrong. The other thing I was thinking is the Jazz owe Minnesota their second round picks in 2025 and 2026. Like, you don't want to give them the 32nd pick or the 34th pick in back-to-back years. Like, that's not great, but those are good. Those are really high-value picks for teams like Minnesota who don't have their own draft assets and want to find ways to continue to add players to their roster. So you would much rather give them 45 or 50, which, again, you can artificially get to. The Jazz could have won 43 games this year had they just not traded Kelly Olynyk and Simone Fontecchio. Instead, they said, we want to win 43 and get the eighth pick or hopefully, you know, top four pick in the draft. They could have drafted 13th, 14th, and it wouldn't have looked like that valuable of a spot. So I think they're going to get up to that spot where they're the, you know, 13th best team in the NBA, 12th best team in the NBA, and convey that pick to OKC. I could be wrong. And maybe they just, and it's going to be determined by how they play over the first half of the season again next year. If they're 8 games over 500, they'll keep playing hard. If they're 8 games below 500, they probably sell off whoever they can sell off again. And it's just, they're going to continue to repeat that process. Danny Ainge isn't going to waste draft assets just to waste them. But to answer Mark's point, I mean, I do think they would like to convey the pick at some point.
To answer his first question, what has surprised you about the playoffs? I would say there's been a few things that I could put my finger on. Most notably is Minnesota being up 2-0 right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest surprise by far.
Yeah. I have a question for you about that. Putting the Nuggets in the middle, looking at the first round and this series now, were the Lakers that bad or are the Timberwolves that good? A little bit of both?
Probably a little bit of both. Yeah. I mean, the Lakers aren't close.
Yeah.
The Lakers aren't close, but all of a sudden what's crazy, again, is that Denver doesn't feel close.
Mm-mm.
Like, Denver, literally Friday night, before the game Saturday, I was like, Denver's going to beat Minnesota. Like, I thought Cleveland was going to make this a series. I didn't think it would be easy. But I thought Cleveland was going to make this a Minnesota was going to make this a series, but Denver was going to win. And they were going to beat whoever, OKC or Dallas, in the next round. And probably have a really good chance to beat Boston because they beat them both times in the regular season. Mm-hmm. You still don't have an answer for Jokic. And now, honestly, I'm like, man, is Denver going to blow this up in 2 years? Like, that is how crazy the NBA landscapes move, because as soon as you are chasing somebody and you don't have a pathway to get there because they are strapped financially, because, again, they've invested max contracts into all these players to keep that championship window, if you've got four guys on max deals or high-level deals, which they do in Jokic, Murray, Gordon, and Michael Porter Jr., and you're not close, there's no reason to keep paying everyone and be over the luxury tax. And Kroenke, their owner, is notoriously cheap in Denver. They have not paid the luxury tax generally. And if they feel like their championship window closes or they need to keep it open by trading off some of those guys, like, man, the league changes unbelievably fast. So that's my biggest surprise, is not even that Minnesota's up 2-0, but how quickly Denver went from, this is the Jokic era of the NBA, to, is Jokic only going to win one title in his career? And like, Jamal Murray went from this guy that we're all talking about, like, yeah, he'll make the Hall of Fame without ever making an All-Star game. And now we're going to be like, remember that 1 year where Jamal Murray was unbelievable?
Yeah.
Now he's just kind of a dude, just like okay guy, but not a superstar player. That's what has surprised me, is how we've kind of, how my opinion has changed on Denver. OKC's doing probably what we expected.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to see what Dallas and OKC do. This could be a great series. I'm excited for that to kick off. Obviously, Milwaukee just being a disaster is
true.
But you know what? One of the things I said the Jazz need to be rooting for is chaos. I've been told by people inside the Jazz that's what they're rooting for. You got chaos.
Definitely.
Milwaukee's gone. Clippers are gone. Denver's about to lose. Like, that's chaos I didn't predict at all. Mm-hmm. Philly's out. Clippers are out. Like, wow.
Yeah.
That's how many, that's of the top 10 players in the NBA that we would just kind of throw out there. Kawhi's there. Paul George might be there. Didn't even talk about the Suns with Kevin Durant and Devin Booker, who are both very firmly planted in the top 10. Joel is out.
Giannis
is out. Like, that's what we thought was 7 of the top 10 players in the NBA. I just named off the top of my head, and I'm probably forgetting somebody that you're listening. And like, yeah, and guess what? Jokic is about to be out.
Yeah. And Lillard is in that conversation-ish, top 15.
Yeah,
probably.
Top 15, 20. Like,
yeah,
half of the top 15 players in the NBA either didn't make the playoffs or are out after 1 year or after one round or will get swept in the second round. It's like, yeah, that's chaos. That's what you're rooting for. And you want that to hit right as there's all this financial uncertainty in the NBA with the new CBA, and the Jazz are sitting there saying, we got picks, we got cap space. What do you need? How can we help ourselves and you at the same time? So it's why they've set it up this way. And they're getting the chaos they hoped for. And I guess you can only hope for more.
Thank you guys for tuning
in. Oh, we got one more question.
Alex wrote one
that he sent earlier in the week. I apologize. And I'll just read it. Alex said, how many teams that have been eliminated are one Lowry Markkanen away from competing, from being in contention? I don't know if anyone eliminated to this point.
Yeah.
Like, okay, you know where he'd be great? Philly. He would be awesome in Philly.
True.
If he could step up and do all the things Tobias Harris refused to do, which are the things Lowry does, make shots and rebound, you'd be great. He would be an awesome fit in Philly. I know their eyes are set on Paul George not picking up his player option or signing an extension with the Clippers this offseason and going to Philly. He would be awesome there. He would be a much better fit right now in Orlando than like Franz Wagner, who decided not to play this first round series, which was an ambitious choice. His first playoff opportunity to sit it out entirely like he did. That was interesting. He would be good on... The nice thing about Lowry is he fits everybody's roster.
Yes.
He would be awesome in Phoenix. Probably a little redundant because they have guys who can score, but he never needs the ball. So that's awesome. He would make the Clippers a lot better. They don't have any trade assets. Like, I mean, that's kind of what you're fishing for. Is who's good, who has trade assets, who might want to go in all in on Lowry. He would look really good in New Orleans.
Yep.
Like he would fit well next to Zion. I wish Zion played harder and tougher and rebounded, but he doesn't. So... I don't know if any of these teams are Lowry away from contention. I think OKC would love to have him if they get eliminated by Dallas, and then Dallas would love to have him if they get eliminated by OKC. Denver could use still another shooter. Like, they can't create their own baskets right now. That's what was so crazy is. And again, the Jazz don't look that big. If you all of a sudden surround all these guys and you have a 7-foot Lowry Markkanen playing the three for you, you see the pathway of how the Jazz are just as big as Minnesota, and he's not as bothered by Jaden McDaniels because he can still shoot over him. As good as Jaden is, it's not that big of a deal. You can't put Nikhil Alexander-Walker on him because he will shoot over you. So he fits everywhere, and he's not, I don't think any of those teams are one piece, one Lowry away from competing.
Yeah, I think that I was going to actually mention this earlier with the last question, just thoughts on the playoffs so far. I think that the Magic surprised me, specifically their performance against the Cavs. I think they are a piece away, but like you said, I don't think Lowry fits a lot of places. I don't think he would really fit there with Paolo and Franz.
They need a guy who can dribble.
Yes.
They need a guard who can create. They would be better with Colin Sexton, which is a name I had thrown out last week, than they would Lowry. And there's a couple teams like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I would actually say the same thing for Phoenix. Phoenix probably needs Colin to come in and be a point guard, not Lowry to be another spacer. They would be better with both or either, but Colin might be more helpful there.
Hey, Orlando, not Klay Thompson.
Don't go get dead Klay.
Yeah.
Yeah, old, dried up Klay. It's not what you need. I know they're thinking about it. Try and get Paul George or sit it out another year and wait.
Yeah.
Or try and get Darius Garland and don't find a way to do it without giving up Franz Wagner if you can. I kind of teased that switch. I'll be curious what... I'm really curious about Franz Wagner. I know a lot of people are like, no, they're just going to give him the max. I wouldn't give him the max.
Oh, no.
You get in real trouble giving good young players the max just because they're good young players and they're not actually great. And he wants the max this offseason. So a lot of question marks there. Anyways, sorry, this is a long podcast.
Very
I apologize for everyone who is stuck listening to this.
Thank you guys for tuning in. Next week, we'll be back with another group of three for our player highlights. And make sure to tune back in. Check out all our socials at KSL Sports. You can follow me at Chandler Holt KSL and Ben at Ben's Hoops.
We'll talk to you next week.
What would you do if your child disappeared and someone you trusted was responsible?
We thought he cared for McKay, when in fact he didn't care for anyone.
Listen to Ransom now at ransompodcast.com.